5:05 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting international backing for unity in Libya. An international consortium of 17 countries and four world bodies meeting in Rome Sunday affirmed support for a UN-backed plan to establish a unity government in Libya. Among those attending, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
We are determined to make the most of the fact that the majority of the House of Representatives and a majority of the GNC have come together ready to sign an agreement. And they refuse any longer to be blocked by one or two people or by the individual politics. They are determined to speak and move forward for Libya, and we are determined to support them in that effort.
Libya's two rival governments are preparing to sign the unity agreement in Morocco Wednesday. An agreed to communique calls on all parties to accept an immediate and comprehensive ceasefire once the agreement is signed. In Central African Republic, voters went to the polls Sunday to pass judgment on a new constitution, but violence and intimidation kept many away from the voting booths, with at least two killed and several wounded. Amadou Gadobe braved the violence in his mostly Muslim neighborhood of Bangui to cast a ballot. He says, if we truly want to give our government and our state a second chance to use all their means, we should all go vote today. If approved, the new document would limit the president to 2 5-year terms, cut the power of the military, and ensure religious freedom. Presidential and legislative elections already delayed are scheduled now to follow December 27. Thousands have been killed and hundreds of thousands driven from their homes since Muslims League of Rebels briefly ceased fire in 2013. This is VOA News. Exit polls in France are projecting voters decisively rejected the country's anti-immigrant far-right National Front in Sunday's regional runoff elections. The National Front topped voting in six of the country's 13 regions in the first round of elections a week ago. The Hudson Institute's Ben Haddad says he's relieved the National Front was denied victory, but said voters are still sending a traditional parties a clear message.
There's also a very high level of distrust among the French population towards the traditional parties. I mean, one of the reasons why the National Front came out so strongly this time is not so much because the National Front vote progressed, but because there's higher abstention and because there's a decrease of the vote towards the traditional parties, because the French population actually considers that these parties have not done a very good job at addressing these very issues.
National Front leader Marine Le Pen had hoped a victory Sunday would serve as a springboard to launch a 2017 presidential bid. As many as 20 women have won municipal council seats in Saudi Arabia's first election, allowing women voters and candidates to compete. However, no final tally has yet been announced. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal says the three most powerful forces within the country are the royal Al Saud family, the clerics, and reformers.
The changes that take place in a place like Saudi Arabia and have taken place so far are very much a function of somebody spearheading the move in the Al Saud group itself, typically the king or the crown prince. So looking at from that point of view, it's an important development, and it may be difficult to put the genie back into the bottle.
The late King Abdullah, who died in January, issued a decree back in 2011 authorizing women to vote. The U.S. government is urging its citizens to leave Burundi amid deadly clashes stemming from political violence. Washington has already ordered non-emergency U.S. personnel and dependents to leave. On Friday, nearly 90 people were killed when armed attackers raided army facilities in the capital Bujumbura. The army has also been accused of extrajudicial killings. Officials in northwest Pakistan say a bomb blast ripped through a busy clothing market Sunday, killing at least 23, wounding some 55 others. The outlawed Sunni Muslim extremist organization Lashkar-e-Jhangvi claimed responsibility. Russian officials say 23 patients in a psychiatric hospital were killed Sunday when a fire engulfed the one-story wooden building. Another 23 were injured in the blaze in the southern village of Alfarovka. Just days after announcing a new finance minister, South African President Jacob Zuma fired David Van Runen. He has been replaced by Pravin Gordhan, who has held the portfolio for 5 years. Controversy touched off after Mr. Zuma sacked a previous finance minister on Wednesday. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Monday, December 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. orders its citizens out of Burundi amid violence as Burundi seeks extradition of private media journalists from Rwanda.
There is no extradition agreement between the two countries. And I don't think that Burundi has the right to ask for our extradition because we are not guilty. We didn't commit any offense.
Patrick Nduwimana is director of the independent radio Bonisha. Diplomats urge Libyan rival factions to unite for peace. Zimbabwe's opposition MDC leader asked for an investigation into corruption allegations leveled against party provincial officials. And South Sudan's military is ordered to shoot down any plane entering the country's airspace without the knowledge of the government.
It is a legitimate right of the government of South Sudan to know whatever plane that enters this area.
Michael Makuei, South Sudan's information minister. We also have reaction from the rebels and activists react to the historic climate change agreement in Paris. Those stories plus Mark Oman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Burundian government is seeking the extradition from Rwanda of four Burundian journalists belonging to a number of private media institutions, Radio Nsanganiro and Radio TV Renaissance. Also wanted is Patrick Nduwimana, director of Bonisha FM Radio. The request was reportedly made by the Burundian Prosecutor General in a letter to the Burundian Minister of Justice. The government launched a crackdown on the independent media after the May 13th failed coup attempt, accusing them of supporting the protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid to run for a third term. Patrick Nduwimana is director of Radio Bonisha and one of the journalists reportedly wanted for extradition. He says the independent media has never taken sides in the Burundian crisis.
This is nonsense because why should the Burundi government ask Rwanda to expel us while we are in exile? We fled because the government, state security and justice just wanted to arrest us, even kill us. We fled because of our safety was not guaranteed, and we asked asylum to Rwanda, and Rwanda accepted to receive us according to international humanitarian law. So I think Burundi has no right to ask Rwanda government to expel or to extradite journalists who fled in Rwanda.
Did the Rwandan government make any representation? Did the Rwandan government approach you or what?
We do not have any contact with the Rwandan government. We are here as refugees. We are here because our life was in danger because the government of Burundi was hunting us.
In my discussion with Burundian government people, the suggestion is that you are wanted because they believe you were part or you supported an insurrection against the government.
This is baseless and is nonsense. Independent journalists or independent media have never been involved in the crisis of the unrest going on in Burundi. They claim that we have been involved or we are linked to the coup that took place in May. But all this is just nonsense. I mean, if we have put on air in our media, in our program, or in our news, the statement of the general who proclaimed the coup against Nkurunziza, this does not mean that we linked to the plan of the coup or the preparation of the coup. We did it as journalists. This was our job. That was a fact. That was an event which happened that time. And we just boycott that statement. So this cannot be a reason or giving, a justification to the government to hunt, even want to kill journalists and media managers.
Now, from your vantage point in Kigali, what is the situation now in Burundi? And this is coming on the heel that the United States has asked its citizens to leave Burundi because of violence in that country. What do you know about what's going on now in Burundi?
What's going on in Burundi today is a tragedy. The Nkurunziza government, Nkurunziza system, is just committing crimes against humanity. What happened on Friday? Okay, there are allegations or there are reports that there is an armed group which attacked three military sites or three military bases in the capital Bujumbura. After that, what happened? Police and government militia and some soldiers went to the neighborhoods, killed young people, Can you imagine two young people who were not armed, they were just at their homes, and they ran up them and they shot them dead. They were not involved in the attack. How can you interpret this? So what is happening in Burundi? I think Burundi government today is guilty of crimes against humanity. That's why, in my view, the Nkurunziza government should be isolated. The international community, the UN, they are taking resolutions, but no action at all. People are dying every day, and they are killed by the government and the system which was, supposed to protect them. How can you interpret this?
Patrick Undewimana is the director of the independent radio Bonisha and one of the journalists reportedly wanted for extradition. He was speaking with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. South Sudan's military has ordered its air defenses to shoot down any airplane or helicopters flying into the country's airspace without the knowledge of the government. The order was reportedly given by General Paul Malong Awan, Chief of Staff of the South Sudan People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, the military forces of the government in Juba. Information Minister Michael McQuay says the government has evidence that some planes or helicopters have been bringing weapons into the country.
This is a misinterpretation of the provision of what the SPLA said. The SPLA said that we have seen that there are some planes and helicopters that do land in government held areas without the knowledge of the government of the Republic of South Sudan. And for that matter, they have warned any other helicopter or whatever plane landing in a government held area without the knowledge of the government that can be shot down. It is a legitimate right of the government of South Sudan to know whatever plane that enters this area. It's not threatening the shooting down of any plane that goes to the rebel held areas. With the knowledge of the government of South Sudan, we have no problem with it. But it is these illegal helicopters that land in some areas that will be shot down if they go there without the knowledge of the government of South Sudan. It's a legitimate right of the government of South Sudan.
So you have evidence that there have been some helicopters landing in the area, in the rebels' held area with weapons?
Yes, not that we have evidence of some helicopters and planes landing in the specific areas within South Sudan. This is why the SPLA issued that communication, warning whoever is seen to be landing in any part of South Sudan without the knowledge of the government of South Sudan, that is a legitimate target to be shot down.
Minister, it seems to me there's too much distrust at the moment between your government side and the rebel side. With the implementation of the peace process in motion, can you two ever work together?
The government of the Republic of South Sudan has ever been clear that we have accepted the peace agreement and we are ready to work for the implementation of the agreement and the overall interest of the people of South Sudan. The government has never been clear on that, and there is no doubt about that. Maybe if it is the other side which is doubting it, that is their problem. But for us as a government, the government has ever committed itself, and it is very clear in the last statement issued by the president to the national legislature, that is the line of the government of the Republic of South Sudan.
Minister, thank you very much again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Michael McQuay, South Sudan's information minister, you are speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Today's Monday, December 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Ezekiel Logat-Kuov, Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, in opposition, says the rebels are calling on the Juba government to immediately withdraw the shoot-down order because it is contrary to the implementation of the August 26 peace agreement. He says the probable reason behind the order could be that the Juba government is not happy with the operations of the UN mission in South Sudan.
They are basically targeting the relief agencies, airplanes of the UN delivering food to the IDPs and refugees in their own country. I don't know why he would be so agitated for the UN to deliver food to the needed population. It is another way of obstructing peace. It should not be tolerated. We condemn this, and we are actually asking for General Malong to withdraw this order. The because it is not in line with the implementation of the peace agreement. And it is also even a clear indication that there are some hardliners who are not interested in making sure that this agreement, which was signed by President Kiir and Dr. Machar, who is going to be the vice president designate, is supported. People are still obstructing. Because if he can give this order, it means that any airplane that is going to the opposition areas, they will be shut down. Or even an airplane leaving opposition areas to go to Juba, even to take delegation to Juba, they can also be shut down. This is not a spirit of peace. We are appealing to all the comrades on the government side to accept peace and then to welcome it.
The allegations, if they are true, is that the government suspects that planes flying in your area have been bringing in weapons.
Well, there are no planes flying to our area to bring weapons. If it is about weapons, you don't need to get weapons from anywhere in South Sudan. You get them from the government because they're available. We get them from them when we were fighting. And the ammunition also, we get them from the government. I don't think this is the reason. It has to be more of the SPLA not being happy with the UN mission in South Sudan operation. And of course, after all, peace is realized. We have signed peace and we are committed to it. So we will never encourage war again.
So, Ezekiel, as things stand, your delegation going to Juba is all in the air. You do not know whether you are going to go and when you are going to go.
Well, the whole world is talking to the government in Juba. We are on the standby. Our team is ready. End time, if the government agree that they are ready to receive them, we are ready to send them in. We are just waiting. The IGAD are on board. They say, yes, the team must go in as soon as possible. The IGAD special envoys, they are on board. The Troika, they are on board. The European Union are on board. China is on board. And the whole world, even the United Nations, they are also on board. They wanted to make sure that our team, the 609, comes to Juba as soon as possible so that we start the implementation of the agreement.
Ambassador Ezekiel Logatkov is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He was speaking with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Top diplomats from the United States, Europe, and the Middle East met with leaders of Libya's rival factions on Sunday in Rome, urging them to adopt a UN-mediated national unity plan and restore peace in the troubled country. International representatives signed a communique expressing support for the plan and warned Libyans that a failure to act would enable extremists to gain ground in their country. Zlatko Kahok has more.
Schools reopened Sunday in the conflict-ravaged coastal city of Benghazi for the first time in almost 2 years.
I'm very happy to go back to school. I'm here because everyone came and life is normal. There is no fear.
Hopes are high that Libya's rival sides will sign a comprehensive ceasefire agreement Wednesday in Morocco, enabling Libyans to return to normal life. United Nations Special Envoy for Libya, Martin Kobler, said it is important that the majority of parties sign the agreement to make it legitimate.
Let me underscore once again, the agreement is not the end of the process, no. The agreement is the starting point of the work to be done by the new government of national unity.
Libya has been unstable since the 2011 ouster of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi. While rival political factions fight for power, the terrorist group Islamic State has created a base in Libya's coastal city of Sirte and is looking to expand. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned that prolonged conflict in Libya may lead to the country's disintegration.
Conflict and instability have just gone on for too long, and the vacuum that has been left there is a vacuum that has been readily filled by extremists, and it takes Libya not to the direction of a government that can serve the needs of the people, but to the direction of chaos.
Kerry's Italian counterpart Paolo Gentiloni also stressed the importance of quick action to restore order.
The message that must be clear today is that in the long term, what matters is the stabilization of Libya, because this too can contribute to the fight against terrorism.
Representatives from 17 countries, the United Nations, the European Union, the African Union, and the Arab League, pledged to help Libya's legitimate government when it is formed. Slarissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwe's main opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai of the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, has instructed his party's Harare province to investigate allegations of corruption being leveled against some of his party councillors. This follows the arrest of three councillors alongside their colleagues from the ruling ZANU-PF on allegations of stealing $70,000 from the Harare Municipal Medical Aid Society and corruptly allocating residential stands to themselves. People's Democratic Party spokesman Jacob Mafume tells reporter Jonga Kandimiri that nothing will change after the investigations.
Corruption from any party is bad. Corruption from ZANU-PF is bad. Corruption from MDC is bad. This corruption must be condemned. The individuals that are perpetrating corruption must be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We must not discriminate corruption. What is happening now, corruption in other parties is being attacked heavily, but corruption in ZANU-PF, it is corrupt for a ruling party to hold a celebration of nothing in Big Falls, eating elephants, giraffes, lions, and crocodiles, while the rest of the country is suffering. They are doing exactly the opposite of what the Tanzanian president, who was recently elected, is doing. And Manyenyeni's MDCT councillors looting when people are suffering.
So, Mr. Mafume, as the People's Democratic Party, what are you recommending?
Corruption must be prosecuted quickly without fail on all parties. The councillors who are stealing must be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And come voting, people must understand that is why we are now changing the political party. We've brought in the People's Democratic Party, which has to be voted in power. We will undertake not to steal the people's money.
Jacob Mafume is spokesman for the opposition People's Democratic Party of Zimbabwe. He was speaking from Harare with Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe program. Historic, but not historic enough, is the response from activists and civil society groups to the agreement reached at the Climate Change Conference in Paris. VOA's Steve Baragona has more.
After a lot of coffee and a lot of late nights, a climate agreement in Paris is in the history books. It's a big deal, says Oxfam America climate change manager Heather Coleman.
This is the first time we've had a legal agreement with all countries at the table. It's truly amazing for those of us who have been working on climate change for a long period of time.
The agreement aims for well below 2 degrees of global warming and recognizes 1.5 degrees as a better target. That's important for key ecosystems and vulnerable people, says Samantha Smith with the environmental group World Wildlife Fund.
It's the Arctic, it's coral reefs, it's tropical forests, but not least, it's every person who is living on the Pacific Islands and in a coastal area.
But the deal reached here will not get the world to 1.5 degrees. National plans submitted ahead of the conference would put the level of warming closer to 2.7 degrees, noted Greenpeace International Chief Kumi Naido.
We have a 1.5 degree wall to climb, but the ladder isn't long enough. The emission targets on the table aren't big enough, and the deal doesn't do enough to change that.
And Coleman says there's not enough attention paid to the biggest victims of climate change.
I don't think poor people got enough out of this deal.
The agreement sets a floor of $100 billion per year to help developing countries mitigate and adapt to climate change. But people in developing countries are already bearing the brunt of the impacts, she said.
Those impacts are going to continue to increase. Poor people need a fair shot. And in order to get a fair shot under a deal like this, we need to continue to increase ambition on finance.
Paris is just the beginning. The deal has countries updating their emissions figures and their commitments every 5 years. And as government policies respond to the new agreement, decisions made here should echo in boardrooms around the world, said Policy Chief Edward Cameron with the corporate coalition We Mean Business.
And we think that that agreement is going to send a message to the real economy that the era of high carbon development is coming to an end and the era of low carbon development is emerging here in Paris.
The conference center is emptying out here outside Paris, but advocates say the next step is just beginning, making sure that businesses and policymakers turn the rhetoric about tackling climate change into reality. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Paris.
It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with rugby. Hosts South Africa beat Argentina 29-14 to triumph in the finals at the Arab Seven Series tournament in Cape Town on Sunday. France pipped Kenya 28-26 in the bronze medal playoff. Zimbabwe lost to Wales 21-12 in the bowl quarterfinals. Consequently, at the end of the second leg of the series, South Africa is second with 35 points, Kenya is ninth with 20 points, and Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. Turning to football, Africa's hopes for glory at the FIFA Club World Cup evaporated after the Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo succumbed to a 3-0 defeat to Japan Sanferese Hiroshima in Osaka, Japan on Sunday. In Senegal, Captain Peter Etebo Ogenekaro scored a brace to cancel the own goal by Oduduwa Segun as Nigeria edged Algeria 2-1 in the finals at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Dakar, Senegal on Sunday. Prior to the finals, South Africa edged Senegal 3-1 in a post-match penalty shootout to clinch the bronze medal. The two sides played to a scoreless draw in open play. Staying in Senegal, Nigeria, Algeria and South Africa qualify for the men's football contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. Nigeria will be playing in the tournament for the first time since the 2008 Beijing Olympics in China, where they bagged the silver medal. Algeria compete at the Olympics for the first time since 1980 in Moscow, Russia, while South Africa make their second appearance at the Games since the 2000 Sydney Olympics in Australia. In handball, Angola play Montenegro at the start of the knockout phase at the World Women's Handball Championship in Nysted, Denmark today, Monday. Earlier on Friday, Angola edged China 32-29 to progress to the knockout phase. In classification matches, Tunisia edged Cuba 28-24 as Kazakhstan pipped the Democratic Republic of Congo 31-30. Today, Monday, Tunisia play Kazakhstan as the Democratic Republic of Congo face Cuba. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, December 14th.
I wish to commend the British High Commission that recently advised Nigeria government to sign disability bills in order to be assisted. This is a great opportunity Nigeria can't afford to miss. I am Fenchon Ishe from Opanuku, in Opudu-Gate Ranch, Cross-Rivers, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The U.S. government is urging its citizens to leave Burundi amid deadly clashes involving military and police. The State Department says it has ordered the departure of non-emergency U.S. officials and the families of personnel as political violence roils the country in the wake of contested elections and an attempted coup in May. And at least six people were wounded Sunday in fighting and gunfire in Bangui as voters in the Central African Republic cast ballots on a new constitution. That's it for this Monday, December 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Next on Let's Talk. First love. Do you remember yours? Are you still in touch? Or is it now history? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing First Love. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.